son in his appeals, and I knew if I hadn't left my knives behind, he would have been dead already, and that would have been too easy an end for him.
Chapter 71.
Sit, I ordered.
Where?
The floor, and don't move. I want to speak with her alone first. I looked at the soldiers who had accompanied me. If he moves so much as a toe, you are to cut it off. They smiled and nodded. I walked through my parents' living quarters and opened the door to their bedroom chamber. My mother lay in a disheveled heap at the foot of the bed, looking like a child's rag doll that had been emptied of its stuffing. My father lay in the center, pale and immobile. Her hand rested on the bed covers that swallowed him up, as if she lashed him to this earth. No one, not even death, would sneak past her. She had already lost her eldest son. Her other sons were missing and in grave danger, and her husband had been poisoned. How she had managed to gather the strength to stand with me yesterday, I wasn't sure. She had drawn from a well that looked empty now. There is not always more to take, I thought. Sometimes so much can be taken that what is left doesn't matter. She sat up when she heard my footsteps, and her long black hair fell in disarray over her shoulders. Her face was gaunt, her eyes veined from tears and fatigue. "It was you who ripped the last page from the book," I said. "I thought it was someone who hated me very much. And then I realized it was just the opposite. It was someone who loved me very much." "I didn't want this for you," she said. "I did everything I could to stop it." I walked across the room, and when I sat beside her, she pulled me into her arms. She held me fiercely, a quiet sob lifting her chest. I had no tears left, but my arms locked around her, holding her in all the ways I had needed to in these past months. She said my name over and over again. "Jezelia, my Jezelia." I finally pulled back. "You tried to keep the gift from me," I said, still feeling the hurt. "You did everything you could to guide me away from it." She nodded. "I need to understand," I whispered. "Tell me." And she did. She was weak. She was broken. But her voice grew stronger as she spoke, as if she had told this story in her own mind 100 times. Maybe she had. She told me about a young mother and her child. A story I had only seen from my vantage point. Her tale had seams I hadn't seen. It was colored with fabric in shades I'd never worn. It had hidden pockets, heavy with worry. It was a story that didn't hold just my fears, but hers too, the threads of it pulling tighter each day. When she had arrived in Morrigan, she was 18, and everything about this new land was foreign to her. The clothing, the food, the people, including the man who was to be her husband. She was so filled with fright she couldn't even meet his gaze the first time she met him. He had dismissed everyone from the room, and once they were alone, he reached out and lifted her chin and told her she had the most beautiful eyes he had ever seen. Then he smiled and promised her it would be all right, that they could take their time getting to know each other. And then he delayed the wedding for as long as he could. And he courted her. It was only for a few months, but day by day, he won her over. And she won him over, too. It wasn't exactly love yet, but they were infatuated. By the time they married, she was no longer looking at the floor, but happily meeting the eyes of everyone, including the stern gazes of the cabinet. Though the seat of first daughter on the cabinet had been ceremonial for centuries, when she told her new husband she wanted to be more active in her role at court, he heartily welcomed her. She was known to be strong in the gift, sensing dangers and folly. At first the king considered everything she said, he sought her advice. But she sensed a growing resentment among the cabinet at the king's attentions toward his young bride, and she was slowly, but diplomatically, pushed aside. And then the babies came. First Walther, who was the delight of the court, then Regan and Bryn, who added to their happiness. They were allowed every freedom, which was new to her. She came from a household of girls, where choices were limited. Here she watched her young boys nurtured and encouraged to find their own strengths, not just by her and the king, but by the whole court. Then she became pregnant again. There were enough heirs and spares, and now everyone waited with expectation for a girl, a new generation to carry on the tradition of first daughter. She knew I was going to be a girl before I was ever born. It filled her with immeasurable joy, until she heard a rumble, a growl, the hunger of a beast, pacing in the corners of her mind. Her misery grew each day, as did the thump of the beast's footsteps. She feared that it stalked me, that it somehow knew I was a threat, and she felt strongly that this was because of the gift. She saw me being torn away from my family, from everything that I knew, and dragged across an unimaginable landscape. She chased after me, but her steps were not as swift as the beast that had ripped me from her arms. I vowed I wouldn't let that happen. I spoke to you as you grew in my belly, and made a daily promise that I would somehow keep you safe. And then on the day you were born, in the midst of my fears and promises to you, I heard a whisper, a soft, gentle voice as clear as my own. The promise is great for the one named Jezaliah. I thought that was my answer, and when I looked into your sweet face, the name Jezaliah fit you best above all the others the kingdom had placed on your tiny shoulders. I thought the name was an omen, the answer I was hoping for. Your father protested at the breach of protocol, but I wouldn't back down. Afterward, it seemed I had made the right decision. From the time you were an infant, you were strong. You had a lusty cry that could wake all of Civica. Everything about you was vibrant. You squalled louder, played harder, hungered more, and thrived. I gave you the same freedoms as your brothers, and you ran freely with them. I was happier than I had ever been. When your formal schooling began, the royal scholar tried to tailor your lessons to nurture the gift. I forbade it, despite his protests. When he finally confronted me, asking for a reason, I told him the circumstances of your birth and my fear that the gift would bring you harm. I insisted he focus on your other strengths. He reluctantly agreed. Then, when you were 12, that's when everything changed. I was afraid and had to enlist the help of the royal scholar to... But the royal scholar is exactly who you needed to be afraid of. He tried to kill me. He sent a bounty hunter to slit my throat, and he secretly sent countless scholars to Venda to devise ways to kill us all. He conspired with them. However you may have trusted him once, he turned on you and me. No, Leah, she said, shaking her head. Of this much I'm certain. He never betrayed you. He was one of the 12 priests who lifted you before the gods in the abbey and promised his protection. People change, Mother, not him. He never broke his promise. I understand your mistrust. I've lived with it ever since you were 12 years old. It made me conspire with him all the more. What happened when I was 12? She told me the royal scholar had called her into his office. He had something he thought she should see. He said it was a very old book that had been taken off a dead Venden soldier. Like all artifacts, it had been turned over to the royal archive, and the royal scholar had set about translating it. What he read disturbed him, and he consulted with the chancellor about it. The chancellor had initially seemed disturbed, too. He read it over several times, but then declared it barbarian gibberish, threw it into the fire, and left. It wasn't unusual for the Chancellor to order barbarian texts destroyed. Most made no sense, even when translated. And this one was no different, except for one key thing that had caught the royal scholar's attention. He retrieved it from the fire. It was damaged, but not destroyed. I knew when he handed me the book along with the translation that something was very wrong. I felt queasy as I began to read. I heard the heavy steps of a beast once again, but by the time I got to the last verses, I was trembling with rage. When you read that my life would be sacrificed, she nodded. I ripped out the last page and threw the book at the royal scholar. I told him to destroy it just as the chancellor had ordered, and I ran from the room feeling like I'd been betrayed in the most wicked of ways, tricked by the very gift I had trusted. Venda didn't trick you, Mother. The universe sang the name to her. She simply sang it back, and you listened. You yourself said the name seemed right. It had to be someone. Why not me? Because you're my daughter. I would sacrifice my own life, but never yours. I reached down and squeezed her hand. Mother, I chose to make the words true. You had to have felt it in your heart, too. You gave me a special blessing on the day I left. You asked the gods to gird me with strength. She looked down at my bandaged hand in my lap and shook her head. But this... I saw all the fears she had harbored for years crystallized in her eyes. Why didn't you ever share this with Father? Her eyes shone with tears again. You didn't trust him? I couldn't trust him not to speak to anyone else. A wedge had grown between us as far as the cabinet was concerned. It had become a contentious subject between us. He seemed as married to them as he was to me. Maybe more so. The scholar and I both agreed it was too risky to tell him because it seemed betrayed by her own could mean someone in a position of power. And that's when you conspired with the royal scholar to send me away. She sighed, shaking her head. We were so close. On your wedding day, I thought you'd soon be gone from Morrigan, and if there actually was anyone here who sought to harm you, you'd be away from them too. Dalbrek was a powerful kingdom that could keep you safe. But then, as I admired your kavah along with everyone else, I remembered the verse, the one marked with claw and vine. I had always thought it meant a different kind of mark, the scars made by an animal or whip. But there, among all the heraldry and intricate designs on your back, in one small part, on your shoulder, there it was. A Dalbrek claw and a Moragis vine. It was only an innocent kavah, I tried to tell myself. Only a coincidence. It would wash away in a matter of days. I wanted to believe it meant nothing. But you had the priest offer the prayer in your native tongue. Just in case. She nodded, exhaustion lining her face. I wanted to believe my plan would still work, but really... I didn't know what would happen next. I could only pray for the gods to gird you with strength. But when King Jackson laid you on your bed and I saw what they had done to you, her eyes squeezed shut. I held her, comforting her as she had comforted me so many times. I'm still here, Mother, I whispered. A few marks are nothing. I have many regrets. But being named Jezaliah is not one of them. Neither should it be yours. My father stirred, and both of our attention shot to him. She moved to his side, her arm cradling his head. Branson? I heard the hope in her voice. Incoherent rambles were all he offered back. There was still no change. I watched her shoulders slump. We'll talk more later. I said. She shook her head absently. I wanted to be with him. The physician forbade it, saying my presence only agitated him. She looked up at me, her eyes sharp, fierce as she had once been. I will see the physician executed for this, Jezalia. I will see all of them dead. I nodded, and she turned back to him, her lips grazing his forehead as she whispered to a man who couldn't hear her, who might never hear her again. I was ashamed I had ever called him a toad. I lingered, staring at them together, feeling dazed, watching the desperate worry in her eyes, and remembering how my father had called for her, my Regina, the tenderness in his voice, even as he lay delirious. They loved each other, and I wondered how I hadn't seen it before. I looked down at the royal scholar still seated on the stone floor. He'd been there waiting for an hour. "I see you still have all your toes," I said. He stretched out a leg and winced, rubbing his thigh. "You and your henchmen were convincing. I assume I can move now?" "I've always loathed you," I said, glaring down at him. "I still do."
"Understandable. I'm not such a likable fellow."
"And you hate me as well." He shook his head, his black eyes looking unapologetically into mine.
"Never. You exasperated, annoyed, and defied me, but it was nothing less than I expected. I pushed you, perhaps too hard at times. Your mother wouldn't let me discuss the gift with you, so I did as she ordered. I tried to make you strong in other ways."
I held on to my hatred, nursing it like a treasured habit, like a nail I had chewed down to the quick. I wasn't done. I wanted more, but I already sensed a truth beneath his deceptions.
"Get up," I ordered, trying to make every one of my words sting. "We'll speak in your former office. My mother is resting."
He struggled to his feet, his legs stiff, and I motioned to a guard to help him. He adjusted his robes, smoothing out the wrinkles, trying to regain his dignity, and faced me, waiting.
"My mother seems to think you can explain everything. I doubt that."
I put my hand on my dagger as threat.
"Your lies will have to be very good to convince me."
"Then maybe my truths would be better."
I saw, once again, the royal scholar I had always known, the one who could snarl and spit at the slightest provocation. His ears flamed red when I accused him of sending scholars to Venda.
"Never!" he shouted.
When I told him about their dirty work in the caverns there, he jumped to his feet and paced his office, calling out the names of the scholars. I confirmed with a nod after each one. He whipped around to face me. Now it wasn't just anger I saw in his face, but stabbing betrayal, as if each scholar had personally gutted him with a knife.
"Not Argyris, too?"
"Yes," I said. "Him, too." His rage caved inward, and he faltered, his chin briefly trembling. I heard my mother's words again. "Of this much I'm certain. He never betrayed you." If this was an act, it was a very convincing one. Apparently Argyris was the lowest blow. He sat down in his chair, his knuckles tapping his desk.
"Argyris was one of my star pupils. We had been together for years. Years."
He leaned back in his chair, his lips pulled tight across his teeth.
"The Chancellor claimed I kept losing my lead scholars because I was difficult. They all left with little notice for remote sacristas in Morrigan." "So they said." "I went to see Argyris a month after he left, but the sacrista said he'd stayed only a few days and then moved on. They didn't know where he had gone."
If he was angry when I told him about the scholars, he was incensed when I questioned him about the bounty hunter sent to slit my throat. He pinched the bridge of his nose and shook his head, mumbling stupidity under his breath.
"I was careless," he finally said. "When I found the books missing and your note in their place, I went about looking for them."
A single brow rose and he shot me a pointed stare.
"You did say you reshelved them in their proper place. I thought they would be in the archives."
He said the Chancellor found him and his assistants tearing the shelves apart and asked what they were searching for, An assistant jumped in with an answer before the royal scholar could say anything.
The chancellor was furious and searched through a few shelves himself before he stormed out of the room, yelling for me to burn the book if I found it, as I'd been ordered to do in the first place. After 5 years, I found it odd that he even remembered the text, since he had declared it barbarian gibberish. I began wondering about him at that point. I even searched his office, but turned up nothing.
That didn't surprise me. My results had been the same. The royal scholar leaned forward, the anger draining from his face.
"I was required by law to sign the single warrant for your arrest and offer a bounty for your return. It was posted in the village square, but that warrant didn't include murder. I never sent a bounty hunter to kill you, nor did your father. He only sent trackers to find and retrieve you."
I stood, walking around the room. I didn't want to believe him. I spun to face him again.
"Why did you ever hide the Song of Venda away in the first place? My mother told you to destroy it, too."
"I'm a scholar, Jezalia. I don't destroy books, no matter what they contain. Such old texts are a rarity, and this appeared to be one of the oldest I had ever come across. I'd only recently placed the testaments of Gudrell in the drawer beside the Vendan text, in what I thought was a secure hiding place. I was eager to translate it."
I saw the energy in his eyes when he spoke of the old texts.
"I translated most of the Gudrell text," I said.
His attention was riveted, and I told him about the history it contained, cautiously gauging his reaction.
"So Gudrell and Venda were sisters," he repeated, as if trying to eat a tough piece of meat, chewing on words that he couldn't quite swallow. "And Morrigan, the grandchild of Gudrell? All one family."
He rubbed his throat as if trying to coax the words down.
"And Jafir de Aldred, a scavenger."
"You don't believe me?" His forehead furrowed.
"Unfortunately, I think I do."
He went to the bureau I had taken the text from, and I watched with surprise as he opened a drawer with a false bottom.
"You have secrets." I had known it that day, but once I had found one secret, I hadn't searched for more.
"Just how many secrets do you have, royal scholar?"
"I'm afraid this is the last of my surprises."
He laid a thick sheaf on his desk.
"What is it?" I asked.
He opened it and spread out multiple documents.
"Letters," he said. "They were found decades ago by the last royal scholar, but they contradicted certain facets of the Morrigese holy text. Like me, he did not destroy rare texts, but they were an anomaly we didn't understand."
"So they were hidden away because they told a different history." He nodded.
"These support what you just told me. It seems the revered father of our people, Jafir de Aldred, was a scavenger who could neither read nor write when Morrigan met him. After they arrived here, he practiced his reading and writing skills by writing letters. I've translated about half of them."
He shoved the stack toward me.
"These are his love letters to her."
"Love letters?
I think you've made a mistake. They couldn't be love letters. According to Gudrell, Morrigan was stolen by the thief Herrick and sold for a sack of grain to Aldred."
"Yes, the letters confirm that. But somehow..."
He shuffled through the pages and read from one that had been translated.
"I am yours, Morrigan, forever yours. And when the last star of the universe blinks silent, I will still be yours."
He looked back at me.
"That sounds like a love letter to me."
The royal scholar had been wrong. He did have another surprise for me, and it seemed the real history of Morrigan would always hold some secrets.
Chapter 72.
The plaza was full. They had come to see Princess Arabella hanged. Instead, I had to tell them I would be leading them in the fight of their lives. I stood on a portico balcony, my mother standing on one side of me, the royal scholar on the other, Rafe and Caden on either side of them. What was left of the cabinet stood behind us. Down below, a row of fidgeting lords, discomfited that the conclave was convening with the citizenry, was afforded seats at the front of the plaza. Just behind the lords, Bertie, Gwyneth, and Pauline stood shoulder to shoulder, looking up at me, their assured gazes giving me strength. Sven, Jeb, Tavish, and Orin, along with squads of soldiers, were poised on the perimeter, watching the crowd. There was confusion, a murmur rippling through the plaza when my mother stepped forward to speak. She told them the king was ill after having been poisoned by traitors, the same traitors who had sent her son and his company into an ambush. And then she named the traitors. At the mention of the vice-regent, a shocked hush fell, as if he stood at the gallows and his neck had just snapped at the end of a rope. Of the cabinet, he was a favorite among the people, making it harder for them to fathom. She told them the plot had been uncovered because of Princess Arabella's loyalty to Morrigan, not betrayal, and that now it was time for them to listen to me. I stepped forward and told them of the threat coming our way, one I had witnessed with my own eyes, a terrible greatness not unlike the devastation described in the holy text. The Khomazar of Venda has amassed an army and weapons that could wipe all memory of Morrigan from this world. Lord Gawain rose, his hands tight balls at his sides. Beaten by a barbarian nation? Morrigan is a strong kingdom. We've stood for centuries, the oldest and most lasting realm on the continent. We are too great to fall. Several lords rumbled agreement, rolling their eyes at the naive princess. The crowd shifted on their feet. "Are we greater than the ancients, Lord Gawain?" I asked. "Did they not fall? Is the evidence not all around us? Look at the fallen temples that form our foundations, the magnificent tumbled bridges, the wondrous cities. The ancients flew among the stars. They whispered, and their voices boomed over mountaintops. They were angry, and the ground shook with fear. Their greatness was unmatched." I eyed the other lords. "And yet, they and their world is gone. No one is too great to fall." Lord Gawain stood firm. "You forget that we are the chosen remnant." Another lord called out, "Yes, the children of Morrigan. The holy text says we have special favor." I stared, uncertain if I should tell them, remembering Pauline's disbelief, afraid I would push them too far. The air stirred warm, circling. They waited, breaths held, heads turning, as if they felt it too. Dihara whispered in my ear, "The truths of the world wish to be known." I looked at Pauline, the struggle in her eyes, the truest daughter of Morrigan. She lifted two fingers to her lips and nodded. The royal scholar added his nod to hers. "Tell them." Venda's voice reached out to me across centuries, still stepping forward, unable to rest. She was blood kin to this kingdom as much as the kingdom named after her. Only one thing was certain in my heart. Long, long ago, three women who loved each other had been torn apart. Three women who had once been family. "Tell them a story, Jezalia." And I did. "Gather close, sisters of my heart, brothers of my soul, family of my flesh. And I will tell you the story of sisters, a family, and a tribe, blood kin of another kind, sewn together by devastation and loyalty." I told them of Gadrell, one of the original ancients, a woman who led a small band of survivors through a desolate world, trusting a knowing within her.
She fed her grandchild stories when there was nothing else to offer. Stories to help a child understand a harsh world, and to keep her silent when predators drew too close. I told them of Gudrell's sister, Venda, another survivor who kept her people alive with her wits, her words, and her trust. After being lured away from her family, she would not be silenced, not even by death, reaching through the centuries for hope for an oppressed people. And I told them about Morrigan, Gudrell's grandchild, a girl stolen by a thief named Herrick, who sold her to a scavenger for a sack of grain. Morrigan was a girl brave and true, who led the scavengers to a place of safety. She trusted the strength within her that was passed down by Gudrell and the surviving ancients, a knowing they turned to when they had nothing else, a seeing without eyes, a hearing without ears. Morrigan was not chosen by the gods. She was one of many who were spared, a girl like any among us, which made her bravery all the greater. Morrigan called on an ancient strength within her to survive, and helped others do the same. That is what we must do now. My gaze skimmed the plaza, the lords, and those standing on the balcony with me. My eyes paused on Rafe, and my throat tightened. Nothing lasts forever, I continued, and I see our end in sight. I leaned forward, focusing on the row of lords. That's right, Lord Gowan. Sight. I have seen the destruction and ruin. I have seen the dragon bearing down on us. I have heard the crunch of bone between his jaws. I have felt his breath on my neck. He is coming. This I promise you. If we do not prepare now, hope is gone, and you will feel the bite of his teeth as I have. Shall we cower and wait for the Khomazar to destroy us? Or do we prepare and survive as our kingdom's namesake did? A small voice. Prepare. Another. Prepare. A fist in the air. Gwyneth's. Prepare. The plaza ignited in shared determination to survive. I kissed two fingers, lifting them to the heavens, one for the lost and one for those yet to come, and called back to them, "We prepare!"
Chapter 73.
Your Highness.
Rafe, Caden, and I were just passing the plaza fountain when the general intercepted me. A dozen soldiers, including Gwyneth, Pauline, Birdie, and Jeb, came to a grinding halt behind us. The general reached out and took my hand, patting it.
"Forgive me for my boldness, Princess Arabella, but I am relieved that the misunderstanding of your treason has been cleared up."
I looked at him uncertainly, already sensing this wasn't going to end well. I remembered him only vaguely, as one of the generals in longest service to the crown. "It wasn't a misunderstanding, General Howland. It was a well-orchestrated lie and plot." He nodded, his lower lip curling in a pout.
"Yes, of course it was a plot by traitors of the worst kind, and we're all indebted to you for exposing them. Thank you."
"No thanks are necessary, General. Exposing treachery is the duty of every—"
"Yes," he said quickly, "duty. And that is what we wish to talk to you about."
Generals Perry, Marquez, and three other officers stood behind him.
"With your father ill and your brothers away, so much has fallen on your tender shoulders. I want you to know there's no need for you to worry yourself about military matters. I can see you've already gotten yourself worked up over this barbarian army, which is understandable considering what you've been through at their hands."
I swallowed. No, not going well at all. Rafe and Caden shifted dangerously on their feet beside me, but I put my hands out on either side. Wait. They got the message. "Worked up, General?" I asked. "Have you ever met the Komazar?" He laughed.
"Barbarians. They change their rulers more often than their underclothes. Today's Komazar is tomorrow's forgotten gutter brat."
He glanced over his shoulder at the other officers, sharing a small chuckle with them, then turned back to me. He tucked his chin close to his chest and angled his head, and I suspected he was ready to confide a great truth that I had overlooked.
"What I am telling you is this is not something for you to fret about. You are not trained in military tactics or even in assessing threats, nor are you a soldier. No one expects you to be. You are free to return to your other duties. We will handle this."
I smiled, and in my sweetest voice said, "Well, that is a relief, General, because I did so want to get back to my needlework. Would you care to pat me on the head now and send me on my way?" His smile faded. I stepped closer, narrowing my eyes. "But before you do, would you please tell me how you'd address the fact that both of these soldiers at my side agree with me about the threat that you think I got worked up over?" He gave Rafe and Caden a cursory glance, then sighed.
"They're both healthy young men, and how shall I say this delicately? Easily influenced by a pretty face."
His smile returned as if he had just educated me on the ways of the world. I was so astonished at his shallow opinion of all of us that for a moment I couldn't speak. I eyed the fountain behind him, but Rafe and Caden beat me to it, their rage bubbling ahead of mine. They stepped forward in unison, each scooping him under an arm, and dragged him backward. The other officers leapt out of their way as they hurled him into the fountain. Rafe and Caden turned, eyeing the other officers, daring them to step forward to help the general. I watched their rage turn to satisfaction when they heard the general coughing and sputtering behind them. My rage wasn't so easily cooled, and I marched to the fountain edge. "And now, General, I hope I can say this delicately enough for your tender ears. In spite of my utter disgust, instead of calling you an ignorant, delusional, pompous, self-absorbed buffoon, I am going to extend my hand and strongly suggest that you take it, because I will not let your patronizing insults nor my pride get in the way of saving Morrigan. As much as I may loathe the idea, I need whatever miserable expertise you will bring to the table, and so when we convene to plan our strategies at a time and place I shall designate, you will be there ready to serve your kingdom. Because, make no mistake about it, I am ruling Morrigan now as my father's regent, and I will get worked up over silly little things like traitors and armies that seek to destroy us. Do you understand?" His chest was a barrel heaving with anger, and water dripped from his nose. I extended my hand, and he stared at it, looking at the other officers, who dared not rush to his aid. He reached out and took my hand and stepped from the fountain. He nodded as if complying with the order and walked away, the sucking sound of water sloshing in his boots. I didn't think the word pretty was swimming in his thoughts anymore. Gwyneth heaved out a generous woof of air.
"Well, I'm glad you didn't call him a buffoon."
"Or pompous," Pauline added.
"Or ignorant,"
Jeb chimed in.
"Or an ass," Caden said.
"I didn't call him an ass," Rafe grunted.
"You may as well have."
Now it was settled. I may have had the confidence of the troops, but at least a few of the officers were still entrenched in a system that had no place for me. Some things last, even after a decisive uprising, and I knew they'd be counting the days until my father recovered or my brothers returned.
Chapter 74, Rafe.
We stood on a long stone dais that looked out on the camp. I imagined peers setting the first stone when it was only a fledgling kingdom. The dais was now 8 stones high, with centuries of battles and victories behind it. Anyone who stood here commanded the attention of the entire camp. Leah spoke to the troops first, and then she introduced me. It was the third group we had addressed. It was necessary to keep the numbers small, especially in this last group. It held all the newest recruits, according to the field marshal, 100 in all. I told this group of soldiers what I had told the others. My presence and that of my soldiers did not mean an invasion, only an effort to help stabilize and prepare their kingdom. I assured them I had no other motives, because with the looming threat, what benefited Morrigan also benefited Dalbrick. When I finished, Leah spoke again, emphasizing the joint effort of our venture and evoking the nods of the generals who stood on the dais with us, including the water-soaked ass whose tongue had dried up considerably since his dunking yesterday. I watched Leah, watched every movement, watched her pace the dais as her voice rose, reaching the last row, watched the soldiers watching her, their attention fixed on every word. Whatever goodwill she had sown before she had left, I didn't know, but the respect the lords had half-heartedly yielded was given freely here. The soldiers listened, and I saw what I had already known, what I hadn't wanted to accept back in Venda. She was a natural leader. This was where she needed to be. Letting her go had been the right choice, even if the decision still burned in my gut. She spoke again, this time getting ready to introduce Caden, and we were all prepared for what was to come. She began her speech as she had the others, but then there was a noticeable departure, at least for some of us.
Vendan drozonis, la bravena enar cadrave, te azione.
Jeb, Natia, and Sven stood behind us, whispering a translation for those of us on the dais who didn't know the language. Vendan brothers, I give you your comrade, the assassin. Leah lifted Caden's hand with her last words, the two of them standing together as a strong, unified front. Then she stepped back so he could speak to the troops. It was both trap and opportunity. We knew Vendans had infiltrated the Citadel Guard, but we needed assurance they weren't also among the ranks. The field marshal and other officers could vouch for the majority, but newer recruits, who claimed to be from the farther reaches of Morrigan, were more of an uncertainty. Leah had addressed them in Morrigese at first, but then switched tongues as effortlessly as a breath. A dozen of us stood on either side of her. It appeared we were there for support, but we had been carefully watching the soldiers, their eyes, movements, and twitches, the clues that would reveal understanding or confusion. Caden continued the address not just to root out, but to appeal to Vendans like himself, who might be swayed. He and Leah had arrived at this strategy together because Vendans working with us could be useful.
Trust the Ciara, my brothers, Jeb interpreted quietly. The Marassi have welcomed her, as have the clans of the plains and valleys. They trust her. The Komazar is the one the Ciara fights, not our brothers and sisters who are still in Venda. Now is your chance to step forward and fight with us. Remain silent, and you will die. Most of the soldiers turned to each other in confusion, not understanding the sudden change of tongue. But a few remained focused, their attention locked on Caden. Second row, a frozen gaze. The soldiers' pupils were pinpoints, worried, understanding, but he didn't come forward. Another on the far right.
Third row, second from end, Pauline whispered.
And then, in the first row, a hesitant step forward. This prompted another in the middle. Only four.
Back row, left end, Leah whispered to Caden.
Keep speaking. 5 Vendan soldiers were found among the ranks, and with the 8 Citadel guards, that totaled 13 impostors, which in itself was a feat. Learning to speak flawless Moragese could take years. The troops were dismissed while other soldiers moved in to detain the suspected Vendans. With Leah's first break in 3 hours, her aunt Burnett swooped in with medicine. Leah took a chug from the bottle, circles still under her eyes. I watched her wipe the corner of her mouth, the tired blink of her eyes, the leveling of her shoulders as she faced her next task, interrogating the prisoners again, hoping one would slip with information or turn on the others as the court physician had. Suddenly, Terevin was selfishly fierce within me. The air, the tastes, every moment, every word between us, and I wished we could have it again, if only for a few hours. Wished I really was the farmer that she had wanted me to be, a farmer who knew how to grow melons, and she was a tavern maid who had never heard of Venda. I watched her walk away with Caden to speak with the Vendans, and then I left in another direction. We weren't in Terevin, and never would be again. Wishes were for farmers, not kings.
Chapter 75, Pauline. The timekeeper was beside himself. He stood off to the side of the dais, fidgeting, waiting for Leah to finish. He had been exonerated, but now he had to follow Leah instead of dictate to her. His pocket watch and ledger had become useless. Tradition and protocol had always been the wheels and grease of Morrigan. Now Leah was. Her aunt Burnett was standing beside him, waiting too. I saw pride in her expression, but also worry. No one was quite sure how to navigate this new Leah. She moved about Civica with force and purpose and no apology. No words were bit back. She didn't have the time. As far as I could see, no one doubted her. She had saved the king's life and exposed traitors who had been plotting right beneath their noses. But I knew they wondered what she had seen and endured these past months. She was a curiosity, as was I. I saw the glances and heard the whispers about Pauline, the quiet, meek attendant who had always followed the rules. What had become of that girl? I wondered myself. Some parts of her were still here, other parts gone forever, and maybe others I was still trying to find. It wasn't just tradition and protocol that had been shattered, but also trust. When the last address was finished, we made our way down the steps at the end of the dais. "Hold up," Gwyneth called to Natia, then sidled up to me. "When are you coming back to the Citadel? I don't like you off by yourself at the Abbey."
"Natia's there, too," Gwyneth grunted.
"And that's supposed to comfort me? She's a kettle ready to explode."
We both watched Natia, who still scanned the dispersing troops, her hand resting on the hilt of the sword that dangled from her hip. Ours weren't the only stares she drew. A young girl armed with 3 weapons, and happy to flaunt them, was not a common sight for anyone in Civica. "She's finding her way," I said. Gwyneth's eyes narrowed. We both knew Natia's history.
"I suppose she is."
She sighed and turned back to me, saying she was taking Natia back to the Citadel.
"She needs a break from her murderous ways."
She shot one last pointed look at me.
"I'll see you there, too, with all your belongings, right?"
"We'll see," I answered. A frown pulled at the corner of her mouth, but she didn't push the matter further. She strolled over to Natia and slung her arm over her shoulder.
"Come on, you bloodthirsty imp. Gwyneth's going to teach you a few new things about subtlety today."
I left in the opposite direction. I was just past the statue of Piers at the gate entrance when I heard someone call my name.
"Pauline, wait up!"
I turned to see Mikhail, and I came to a dead stop, stunned that he had the nerve to approach me.
"I know what you're thinking, Pauline," he said, "but I was only following orders. I'm a soldier, and..."
"And you've already spent all the reward money? Or are you afraid now because I'm part of the new cabinet, and I could do all manner of things to you if I choose to?" His eyelids twitched, and I knew I had hit the mark. "Get out of my sight, you groveling parasite!" I pushed past him, but he grabbed my arm and whirled me around.
"What about our baby? Where is..."
"Our baby? You're mistaken, Mikhail," I growled. "I already told you, the father is no one you know." I tried to yank away again, but his fingers dug into my wrist.
"We both know that I'm..."
And then there was the crack of a fist on flesh, and he was flying through the air. He landed with a thud, flat on his back, a cloud of dust erupting around him. Caden was upon him, grabbing him by his collar and hauling him to his feet. Molten rage twisted Caden's face.
"You have a question about the father, soldier? I'm the one to ask. And if you ever lay a hand on Pauline again, it will be more than a split lip I give you."
Caden pushed him away, and Mikhail stumbled back, then froze. He knew who Caden was, the assassin of Venda, who could have easily gutted him without making a sound. But more than that, I saw another assumption settling over Mikhail's face. Maybe it was true. Maybe he hadn't been the only one in my life. His inroad to me was gone. He wiped his lip and turned away, disappearing into the milling soldiers. I saw Caden's shoulders heaving, as if he was trying to dispel the last of his anger. He told other soldiers who had stopped at the commotion to go back about their business before he finally turned to face me. He brushed the hair from his eyes.
"I'm sorry, Pauline. I saw you trying to pull away, and I..."
He shook his head.
"I know I had no right to intervene or imply that..."
"You already knew who he was?" He nodded.
"Leah told me he was still alive, and I put it together. The same shade of blonde as the baby. Your reaction."
The color on his neck suddenly deepened, as if just realizing his admission. He had been watching me. His eyes bore into mine, and I saw 100 questions behind them I hadn't seen before. Would I ever forgive him? Had he gone too far? Was I all right? But mostly, I saw the kindness in them I had seen the first time I met him. Silence and dust motes hung in the air between us.
"I'm sorry," he finally said again, and glanced at his knuckles that were red from the blow to Mikhail's face. "I know you wouldn't want it to appear that a barbarian assassin..."
"Will you walk me back to the Abbey, Caden?" I asked. "If you have the time. Just for appearances, in case he's still watching." He looked at me, surprised, perhaps even fearful. But he nodded, and we left for the Abbey. Both of us knew that Mikhail wasn't watching.
Chapter 76.
After my aunts and Gwyneth helped me bathe and dress, I shooed everyone from my room. For almost a week now, I had been consumed in meetings with generals, officers, and lords, and today I had addressed more regiments who had arrived after being called back to Civica. I needed one quiet moment. I remembered what Dihara had told me about the gift. "The walled inn, they starve it just as the ancients did. You're surrounded by the noise of your own making." And there had been a continuous stream of noise, most of it passionate and loud. Wraith, Caden, and I led private talks with Generals Howland, Marquess, and Perry, Captain Renault, the Field Marshal, and Sven and Tavish. I personally greeted General Howland, trying to put our rocky start behind us. Our team of 10 gathered maps, made lists, and devised our strategies. Caden and I told them in vivid detail about the weapons and numbers we faced. 120,000. When the field marshal suggested that the Komazar might divide his forces to attack on many fronts, Caden assured him he wouldn't. The Komazar would hit with his full force on Morrigan, ruthlessly plowing his way to Civica to make it a quick, decisive victory. I agreed. The Komazar's blood pulsed with the power this army gave him. He wouldn't divide it. I remembered his face as he beheld his creation. Its immense, crushing impact was a thing of beauty to him. During our meetings, arguments erupted over everything from timing to routes the Komazar would take to the best ways to arm our soldiers. One thing was clear. We needed more, so that call was sent out too. More weapons, more soldiers. The lords were sent back to their counties with the same orders for recruits and supplies. All of Morrigan was enlisted in the effort. Metal of all kinds was brought to the forges to repurpose into weapons. Gates, doors, teapots. No item was too small or too important that it couldn't be used to save the kingdom. The mill was tapped to work around the clock. More wood was needed to build stockades, pole arms, and defenses yet to be imagined. Training began as well, the sharing of skills, because it was undeniable that Dalbrecht's soldiers had a refined discipline that would be helpful. Initially, this rankled the officers, the prospect of Rafe's regiment of 100 soldiers training Morrigi's troops, but I snuffed that argument cold, making it clear that pride was not to be an obstacle to our survival. And Rafe smoothed it over, genuinely reaching out for advice from them as well. I was caught off guard several times when I saw Rafe and Caden explaining, or arguing, strategies. I saw them both in ways I never had before, in ways that had nothing to do with me, ways that were all about their own histories and hopes, obligations and goals. I watched Caden, skillfully skirting questions about the future of Venda, even as he plotted to strengthen Morrigan. Some of our battles had to be waged later. They still called him the assassin, not in a disparaging way, but almost as a badge of honor that a Morrigese citizen had infiltrated enemy ranks and now returned to his own with Venden's secrets. As the days passed, meetings ran long and tensions ran high, I realized most of the outbursts were not about pride as much as dawning realization of the monumental fight ahead of us. They fully grasped it, including General Howland, and everyone searched for answers that were not easy to find. How does an army of 30,000, still scattered across the kingdom, take on one that is 120,000 strong and armed with far deadlier weapons? But we kept trying to find an answer. When we pulled out maps and unrolled them across the table, I tried to read the Komazar's mind. I looked at the roads, the hills, the valleys, and walls surrounding Civica. The lines and landmarks blurred, and something faint tapped beneath my breastbone. The details of our meetings whirled constantly in my mind. It was hard to block out the noise, but I knew I needed to use other strengths as well, a knowing that would help guide us because my doubts about all our strategies were growing, and each day wrung tighter with worry about my brothers and their squads. I threw open my window, the cool night air shivering over my face, and I prayed. To one god or four, I wasn't sure. There was so much I didn't know, but I knew I couldn't bear losing two more brothers. There had been no word, but Rafe had already told me there would be none. They would either come or they wouldn't. I had to hope and trust that the message had gotten there in time. "Bring them home," I begged the gods. And then I called to my brothers, just as Walther's words had reached out to me. "Be careful, my brothers. Be careful." I stared out over Civica, the eventide remembrances quieting, a thin song still clinging to the air. So shall it be forevermore, forevermore.